All right, what is up, Crypt Nation? Welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. And today's show is sponsored by Gods Unchained, the digital card game that offers true ownership to players. So gamers, listen up here. Cards are minted on Ethereum, meaning users can trade, sell, and program their assets however they like. And actually, a new expansion set just got released with limited edition cards and ERC-20 chests available for sale. And if you miss out, you can hunt down these or other previously sold out chests on third-party sites like Uniswap. This game is the real deal, guys. It's helmed by experienced TCG legend Chris Clay of Magic the Gathering. So, guys, it is fun, it is engaging, it is competitive, and it has more NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, right, than any other Ethereum game on the market. So you could support the channel, and you could try the game out for free. Just click the link in the show notes. Before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy-to-understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on, you know, how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, all you wonderful, good freaking citizens here of Crypt Nation. Welcome back to another high caliber episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. Pete, what are you doing over there, brother? We are in the studio. Life is good, but give me some updates here before we dive into our awesome guest.
We are just entering Q4, and I like to look back and reflect on things. You know, history is often an indicator of what the future may bring. And this is, without a doubt, the craziest year, the wildest year of all of our lives. The ups have been so high, the downs have been so down. It's almost like life itself is rebasing. So we needed to bring on some rebase experts and get an update on another particular project that has also had some crazy ups and downs this year. So I'd like to welcome the co-founders of Ampleforth, Brandon Isles and Evan Kuo. Welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yes, I'd be here.
So, Brandon, we had you on about 9 or 10 months ago, and Ampleforth was below $1 million market cap. And then 2020 happened, and we saw a lot of changes. I think the market cap had hit almost as high as about $600 million, maybe a little bit more, and a lot has changed. So catch us up. I want to know about some key milestones that you guys have hit in 2020 since we last spoke.
Sure. Yeah. So this summer was a huge sort of eventful time for the project. In June was a kind of big turning point. So June is when we launched what we call the Geyser program, which is a liquidity mining program. After that launch, we saw a huge influx of, you know, attention and users and growth, just like you talked about. Us as a kind of small team, we were previously kind of a small, nerdy academic-y style project that lots of people didn't really think about very much. And we suddenly were in a position where we were trying our best to keep up with everything as it's going on. And so that's been the kind of story of our project since then. Yeah, real quick on what that geyser was it was a way, it was like a open participation rules-based way of distributing tokens out into the world, right? So we call it liquidity mining because it's, we view it as sort of our version of Bitcoin's proof of work, or like miners on a Bitcoin system. And so the way it operates is anyone can sort of get a drip of ample tokens from the liquidity mining fund by providing liquidity on chain on centralized exchanges. So
I think that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's huge success. I think part of what it did was it created like a sort of defined point in time where lots of people could, in the same point, you know, look at the project and then see other people looking at the project also. And so I think that gave a lot of people the confidence to act because they could see everyone else doing it. Whereas before, it was sort of like a trickle of people here and there. And there wasn't much going on, so there wasn't much for them to do. So I think that was sort of the sort of linchpin of what caused a lot of the activity.
Yeah, I would say like another way to put it is we went from, like Brandon said, this tiny nerdy product that nobody really knew about and we had a hard time explaining to people to something that's been cloned like 10 times over now, right? And now people know what it means to rebase and they have all these expectations for what that might do to the growth of a product or project. And here we are.
It was one of those moments for me personally. You know, I was trading Ampleforth a little bit back in the day and never, you know, for me, I was just curious about it. And it was the only coin, it was the first time in crypto when I had, you know, taken my coins off the exchange, put them in my MetaMask and woke up the next day and had a different amount of coins. So I was like, wait, what the heck? What just happened? And like that for me was the moment when I realized what rebasing was. And it was, you know, after I had spoken to Brandon and still was trying to get this idea in my head of, you know, non-dilutive, and staying everybody stays equitable with their percentage in the network and trying to understand what that meant. But then I realized it's like, oh, wow, the supply changes, but my percentage ownership in the entire, you know, equity of this, you know, quote unquote equity of this entire network doesn't change. And that was a really big moment for me. And then, like you said, you know, a bunch of projects came off and kind of did the same thing, some successful, some, you know, catastrophic. Right. I'm curious about what are some of the most surprising things that you guys learned this year when you guys launched your project? Like you said, it was a small academic project, just, you know, a small team, everybody working, and then you launch it into the wild and then the market picks a hold of it. And what were some surprises and some twists and turns?
Well, definitely the fact that the project kind of got out on 4chan and rebasing became much more than what we expected it to be. So for us, it's a mechanism for increasing or decreasing the quantity of tokens in user wallets systematically and universally. But it also became this cultural phenomenon, right? Because it happened in this predictable fashion every single day, at, you know, 7 p.m. Pacific. It became something that people on Telegram started to kind of rally around and count down to and send a bunch of memes kind of in advance of, and so it became a bit of a cultural phenomenon, and that allowed a lot of other people to continue to join. And so, you know, people started to really pile in with kind of different levels of understanding around, you know, what it is we were doing here. So like you said, you had this kind of, you know, aha moment where you noticed that the number of coins actually changed in your MetaMask wallet and no transactions had been sent. And that was itself cool. And when combined with the geyser, that became a really kind of compelling reason to buy more Ample or to like invest in the liquidity mining pools. But from there, the question of like, well, why might you want a coin to act that way as opposed to being like Bitcoin where price just moves up and down? Why would you want supply to move up and down in that way? Became a question that was kind of not fully answered. There was such a frenzy around like, oh my God, it's compounding in value. I have to buy now if I think I've missed the opportunity. And for project, it's like, oh my God, there's a cultural phenomenon being created. I have to clone it now or I missed the boat. All of this kind of speed really kicked in. And I think it brought in this era of like high speculation and high growth for DeFi was kind of the beginning of the latest wave. And now we've seen it kind of evolve into vegetable coins and clones. And, you know, it was surprising for us to see that cultural phenomenon, but it was also surprising, I guess, to see that many of these projects are doing things like executing variations of the AmpleForth protocol that Brandon and I had talked about, like, you know, as long as 2 years ago. And we kind of even modeled out a lot of these outcomes. And so it's cool to see some of these thoughts that we've had in the wild. And, you know, largely they're playing out the way we expected them to. But the other thing that we didn't see, or I guess there's three things. So number one, the cultural phenomena. Number two, the fact that the quantity theory of money, this thing that we talk about in economics as being only true, maybe in the long run, not true in the near term, is in fact true on these automated market making platforms like Uniswap, where as soon as you adjust supply, price correspondingly adjusts, right? That happens in real time on these AMM platforms. That wasn't something we had assumed to be true. And it's not something that economists would generally assume to be true in the near term. And
so it would mean it kind of confirms the inefficient market or the efficient market.
It's just this weird thing. Normally, like, you know, when supply changes, like say you had a crop of wheat in your backyard, it rained, you suddenly have more wheat. You don't expect the price of wheat to immediately change, right? You have to take your new wheat and put it on the market and say, I'm willing to sell it for X dollars. And the whole market has to eventually adjust to that information. You don't expect price to instantaneously change. But on Uniswap, price does instantaneously change. And that is another kind of factor in this. And then lastly, the thing that I think is really surprising and new is just the power of decentralized governance, or, you know, I guess the trend of decentralized governance, how people are really rallying behind that and creating value around that. These are all kind of, I don't know, we've always thought to design a system that has a minimal amount of governance, right? As opposed to a maximum amount of governance that's like in the hands of the community. You want something that's like, doesn't require a great deal of governance. That's kind of our view. But this kind of opposing view, which I think I understand and appreciate quite a lot now, is coming into fruition, where it's like you want maximum control in the hands of the community. And so these are all just kind of really interesting movements.
Yeah, I think one thing that surprised me was just the speed at which community and capital was able to mobilize. That was also part of the scariest part too, because from talking with various people, we've gotten some comments like, okay, the conversations around Ample are actually the closest to the conversations that I remember having back in 2011, 2013 around Bitcoin, like around the Thanksgiving dinner table, people trying to figure out what this thing is, where the value comes from, that sort of thing. Issued some tweets sort of in a tongue-in-cheek fashion before saying, hey, you probably shouldn't buy Ample unless you've studied it for 2 weeks. Like, that was kind of supposed to be humorous, but not completely off the mark either. And so to see the amount of people participating as quickly as they did, and a lot of them not seeming to really understand the underlying mechanics, I think surprised me the most and took us off guard. You know, it's maybe the scariest thing for us to watch.
It's been a very fascinating financial experiment all around. I remember when Brandon came on the podcast and Bryce and I were talking about it afterwards. I was like, well, I'm not sure about investing in something that's designed to be a stable coin, essentially, because the idea is it's almost like a big bang and the center of gravity is $1 and its supply is going to decrease and increase to try and get that price closer to a dollar. That was my understanding of it at the very, very beginning. And I said, well, I don't know if I really get it, but, you know, we'll check it out and we'll see. We had no idea that we would see a 50% swing in either direction, sometimes greater. And of course, that's caught the eye of many, many people. So what is some of the reasons that this incredible volatility exists? And will that volatility decrease over time as it's on more exchanges or more people participate? Or is it really just a timing thing that people who have studied it for 2 weeks can take advantage of? Where is it now?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those things. Again, everything happened so quickly. People went from thinking we're these geeky, you know, academic engineers developing a stable coin to then finally understanding the mechanism behind it. But the why is also important. And one of the things a lot of people get wrong is they think it is designed to be stable because a price target exists, when that's really not quite the, you know, the purpose of it. The price target is a goalpost that we put in the ground because the system needs to know whether there's more demand than supply or less demand than supply. I don't really know that there's any other way to gauge that other than having a price target. So it's more of a means to an end than an end itself. So it's a way to tell the system whether we need to increase the supply of ample or whether it needs to decrease the supply of ample. Not necessarily a goal in itself to just kind of remain fully stable. And as you saw, there was a great deal of kind of value appreciation as a result of this so-called kind of stable protocol. Well, it's because it wasn't designed to be stable anyways. And some of the history behind like what motivated this design actually kind of reaches much further back than Bitcoin even. Early on, Brandon and I were really sitting in a room scratching our heads, trying to ask what the application of a blockchain technology even really was. We kind of came to this soft conclusion that it was the opportunity was to create new monies, right? That's what the Bitcoin protocol had achieved. It was able to articulate scarcity in a purely digital context, and it did so in kind of a censorship resistant way. And it did so at huge concessions, right? It was slow, not very usable. You know, it made grave sacrifices to achieve that. And so the next question for us was like, okay, now that we understand what the opportunity here is, like, how would you design a better money? And so we sought out some academic advisors and, you know, basically they said like, it's kind of like a digital gold, right? And it'll run into some of the same issues that gold runs into. And there aren't many issues, by the way, but when you have kind of a fixed supply asset, you run into problems if you try to use it as the cornerstone or build or a key building block in a new banking ecosystem, right? So, for example, under Bretton Woods, we had dollars that were redeemable for gold by central banks and foreign governments. Now, people were still paying for coffee using dollars. Like, you know, wages were denominated in dollars, right? Goods and services were denominated in dollars. But the base money, the collateral asset, the building block money that connected this system was gold. And what happens when you have a system like that is some shock in demand or supply can lead it to kind of go into kind of a deflationary spiral, right, in some circumstances. So, for example, under Bretton Woods, the dollar was a reserve currency, just like the dollar is today. And so lots of people outside the United States were demanding dollars for their economy to function. And the rate of demand for dollars outpaced the rate at which we could actually obtain the gold to back those dollars. And what happens in a situation like that is the price of gold starts to skyrocket, which further increases people to hold onto their gold, right? Rather than spend it because they think it's going to be worth more the next day. So in these scenarios where really what the system needs is more of the base money, the incentive is actually to withhold the base money, which can cause the system to collapse. And that's why we left the Bretton Woods gold redeemability standard. And so we asked our academic advisors and we kind of did a bunch of research ourselves and said, well, what kind of asset would we have been able to swap for gold one for one under Bretton Woods and still function? And, you know, it's not Bitcoin, right? So even under ideal conditions, if we took gold out of the equation as the base money and put Bitcoin in, we'd be facing exactly the same dilemma. What we would need is an asset that's like gold, except for supply elastic, right? So something that runs automatically, that, you know, operates based on a set of rules, but that is elastic so that it doesn't run into a liquidity crisis. And so from the get-go, we were envisioning Ample as a building block asset, right? And so this is something that people often get confused because in today's world, the base money is also the exchange money, right? So the paper money that we use as the outside money or base money of you know, the US dollar, it can also be used to exchange for goods and services, but not so long ago that these things were different. And I think it's kind of an interesting analogy because if you think about crypto today as a new generation of precious metals, then you can kind of think of DeFi as this new generation of banks that's being created to trade and borrow against these precious metals. And so we're kind of faced with that same building block dilemma again today. And so I guess it's a long-winded way of answering your question, which is like, it's not designed to be stable. It's designed to be a building block for a new generation of digital banks.
Right. And one of the cool things that I like to think about is just it has a completely different footprint than a lot of the other coins. Like if you look at the charts, like, you know, Pete's and I, Aaron and I are trading pretty often, and you see most of these charts have very similar patterns. But the Ampleforth chart has a completely different pattern. It's just extremely uncorrelated. So that's what makes it very attractive as like a way to de-risk your entire portfolio. But, you know, Brandon, maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the games that these traders are playing. Because in my mind, when Ampleforth goes above a dollar and you start to get more supply on the market, you would think that that would cause the price to want to rebound back to that base of, you know, a dollar. And that's probably the idea. But what's happening is traders are using that push above a dollar, taking all the momentum and driving it up, because they know that the more that they have every day at 7 p.m., they're going to get more, right? They're going to get more. And they're not going to be diluted with that. And so it really does have like a really interesting characteristic. But maybe you could just talk about some of the market dynamics that you're seeing that you might find interesting and stuff like that.
Yeah. So honestly, I can only guess at some of these. Like some of them you can see, but I can't claim to have complete visibility over the entire marketplace. I don't think anyone can.
Right.
But there are some patterns that we've been able to sort of, you know, point to since last summer. Shortly after the liquidity mining program, when there was such a huge influx of people coming to the system and trading, we did see a very large growth of trading activity as well, right? So before we launched the program, we were a very small pool on Uniswap. Our goal was to be in the top 10 pools. And so we needed to have about $1 million of liquidity together back then. The high point of this project, we had almost $100 million of liquidity in the Uniswap pool. And we were also representing, over 50% of the trading volume of Uniswap for a long period of time too. And then, Uniswap as the, third biggest user of gas on Ethereum meant that people just trading Ample was a significant portion of all Ethereum activity for a good amount of time.
So you guys are blamed for all those high gas fees.
I don't think we are anymore. But for a while, yeah. I think, maybe a lot of the DeFi craziness happens, since that time period too. And, things started moving a lot faster just in the space at all with the way the pattern of development has gone. Because the rebase was a defined point in time every day, 2 a.m. UTC, which is 7 p.m. Pacific or 10 p.m. Eastern for those in the U.S., we saw a lot of concentrated activity and trading around that time period too. So, and there were lots of different, strategies people would do. They would try to, buy before the rebase and sell afterwards, or, even front run that and sell before the rebase or buy afterwards. We actually saw it sort of like flip a couple of different times where people were trying to, react to what other people were doing. So I think there's a big group of people who are active traders, and there's also a big group of people who are more passive holder types as well. So that's one cool thing about the project, is that you're not penalized for being a holder, right? That's the same way you weren't with Bitcoin, right? Because it's non-dilutive. If you own 0.1% or whatever percentage, you'll always own that until you decide to make a transfer. And so the active traders are sort of competing with each other. So they're playing a different zero-sum game, where if they're actively trading, if you come out ahead, you might increase your percentage ownership. But if you come out behind, you might decrease your percentage ownership. So some people care about percentage ownership. They tend to be like long-term supporters of the project. Other people are, only pay attention to like dollar-denominated gains and losses, on the order of days. And so I think there's very different profiles of people who are participating.
Yeah, but to your point, it does have a different movement pattern. That became kind of the thesis of our paper. So originally we designed this to address kind of, the problem of gold and fixed supply commodity monies as a base money for a banking system. But then upon analyzing further, we're saying, well, because the value accrues directly to people who are holding the coin, this might result in a completely different movement pattern, which would make the Ample a really interesting asset to hold for diversification. So then it was just like, okay, cool. Let's see what happens, right? We have the thesis that it introduces a new set of incentives. And if it's correct, then, it'll finally start to decouple from Bitcoin, and folks, just regular folks who buy and hold crypto, can start to sprinkle it into a basket of assets. And it can be useful for that reason. And that part has largely played out to be true. So we had a follow-up study, I guess, probably since you last spoke with Brandon with the Gauntlet Network, who did kind of a historical correlation analysis and also kind of a movement pattern analysis. And, you know, all the indications are pointing in the right direction, which is that, cool, this thing can actually move differently. And that's, even that has kind of a historical analog. You know, we had all these precious metals in the past and they had clear economic functions. They were being used kind of as a check against inflation or a check against boom bust cycles, but there were many of them. It wasn't just like gold or variations of gold. It wasn't as though we only had gold bars and gold coins and gold bracelets. We had gold and we had silver, we had copper, we had all these other things that you could hold in a basket. And that was kind of one of the goals with the Ample too, just to kind of be the first actually different cryptocurrency that moved differently. And we're kind of happy that has happened, which is pretty cool.
This question isn't on the agenda, so we can strike it if you guys don't want to answer it. But just following up what Evan was just saying is how it moves so uniquely. Do you guys want to riff for a little bit on why all these other coins are so correlated, even though they do vastly different things from Bitcoin also?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we have, you know, thought about because, for example, like Litecoin has a different emission schedule than Bitcoin. Right? Why should it move in perfect lockstep? Like Ethereum is a decentralized global computer, not a digital gold. Why should it move perfectly like Bitcoin? Like basic exactly. Attention token is a browser, right? It serves a totally different function. Why should it move exactly like Bitcoin? And the theory that I came up with, and I think, or Brandon and I mean, the theory that like stands out in my mind that I don't know how to test is that like, Bitcoin is the big player in the game. And, you know, a lot of the trading activity is systematic. And, you know, we know it's kind of like if you're an algorithmic trader and you're trying to operate across 1,000 coins, and historically they've been moving in lockstep with Bitcoin, well, you'd be foolish to kind of execute a strategy that assumes that it doesn't continue to do that. Right. And yeah, go ahead.
I think an important observation is that economically speaking, a lot of these tokens are functionally very, very similar, even if they might have different underlying utility, right? So you can have a utility token like BAT or something similar like that that has, you know, a use value on a particular network. But as long as the, you know, speculative use case dominates the utility use case, the transactional use case, you're going to see it operate as a sort of speculative type asset. And so I think there's a good chance that at some point in the future, the most successful utility tokens will be correlated with the actual transactional use case. And we're not quite there yet because there's so many speculators out there in crypto. And we don't know how long it'll take or if it'll ever go away, because you can always, as long as there are exchanges, you can speculate on these things.
Yeah, these are kind of largely monetary assets, right? They are all perfectly good media of exchange, right? And there happen to be floating price assets. And even if they have slightly different kind of offset emission schedules, as long as they're floating price assets, you know, they're just going to end up trading like all the other floating price assets. And I think, counterexample of that would be the Binance token. That's like a utility token, right? Except they have this kind of discretionary burn that's connected to their revenue. So if you're actively adjusting supply in response to something like that, then that can cause you to move a little bit differently. But with Ample, the supply changes are so frequent, and those supply changes accrue directly to users. It does kind of force a different type of strategy altogether.
Lost my train of thought.
Awesome. Well, I was going to pop in and just say, while we're on the topic of correlation, you know, we've seen very clearly the stock market act as a correlated, have some correlation to the crypto markets and vice versa. Do you guys think that, you know, both of them are clearly risk on assets right now, but do you think that in the future, 5-10 years down the line, whatever, I mean, there will be some type of non-correlation there, like some Bitcoin and crypto will start to break away? Because just anecdotally, I ask this just because people like come up to me and they're like, hey, what the heck happened? Like in March when the stock market sold off, like crypto sold off too. Shouldn't they have like an inverse relationship? I'm like, well, not yet. It's too small. It just trades like a risk on asset. When everything gets sold, then crypto is going to get sold too. But I think maybe down the line, it could kind of be a hedge? I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Maybe Evan, you could start.
Yeah, that's a really important question to address here, because I think in general, there might be some confusion between an uncorrelated asset and an inversely correlated asset, right?
So, oh, okay.
Right. So there's a difference between being anti-correlated to the stock market and just being uncorrelated. And so there's a great deal of history behind Bitcoin. For the first 10 years, it was just kind of not correlated with stocks, precious metals, and things like that. Now we've seen it start to kind of snap into lockstep with assets like gold. We've also seen it, you know, snap into a correlation pattern with things like S&P futures and stocks, right? But really, I think the way I would describe it is it's an asset that doesn't have a direct connection to traditional indicators of consumption and production, right? And it is certainly a risk on asset. And so I think that in a situation like the middle of March, when the stock market, you know, started to collapse, you want to get, the only move is to get out of your risk assets, right? And the only asset that you can buy that's not really a risk asset is dollars. You don't buy gold in that situation. You don't buy stocks. You just move into dollars, right? And then you enter into a scenario where, okay, maybe I want some risk. What kind of risk can I reasonably take, right? And maybe you're looking at like, okay, should I buy airline stocks? Well, nobody's traveling right now. Like, should I buy whatever? Like, there are things that are actually connected to these indications of growth in various sectors, and Bitcoin isn't one of those things. So it's an interesting asset, particularly, I think, when things are stagnant, it can start to kind of grow more quickly than other things might grow, because like it doesn't care about the cost of borrowing capital or employment rates or expected GDP growth rates. Bitcoin doesn't really have to adhere to those things. It doesn't directly affect it. Whereas like things like Apple stock, for example, might be affected by trade sanctions and supply chain disruptions and things like that, right? That are more macro. So I think, you know, the function of things like Bitcoin kind of, they show their value in a stagnant economy where people are seeking additional volatility that's uncorrelated to traditional indicators of consumption and production. And of course, in a bull market, everything goes up, right? So risk assets go up because people just want more volatility, because the general trend is that people are buying more and more of these assets. I think in a kind of recession or kind of in a down market, when you're trying to relieve yourself from risk, people are just going to retreat into dollars. And so what I'm trying to paint the picture of here is that there's a function of an uncorrelated risk asset that carries a great deal of economic value. And that's not connected to it being inversely correlated or a safe haven against geopolitical calamity, right? And that's what we've been talking about all the time. Just like, where does it belong in a portfolio and under what circumstances does it belong in a portfolio? Does that help?
Which is a funny thing to say, because what we're sort of saying here is that Bitcoin is the most successful in periods of stability or stagnation, right? Where there's this sort of search for volatility. But we've all probably also heard the saying that Bitcoin is an option on chaos, because when everything starts burning, Bitcoin is just going to continue to do its thing, right? And so it's two different things. Maybe there is a breakpoint where the second one starts to overpower, but that's like so far down the line that like everything else won't
matter. It's not true today, right? So I don't think that it is yet that safe haven asset, right? And even in a dire scenario, say the power goes out, you're going to want gold, not Bitcoin, because the internet's out, right? Or you're going to want milk and, you know, spam, right? So
water.
Exactly. Water, the basics. So I think it's a really great uncorrelated risk asset. And there will be very good times for that, particularly in periods of stagnation. And for sure, when people are looking for extra volatility in times of growth, crypto is great to sprinkle in. But in a crisis, no, it's not yet there.
Very, very well said, guys. That was super insightful. You guys have had a hell of a year yourselves through all this chaos. And it looks like you're in good shape right now. There's a lot of things that have, as we mentioned earlier, are borrowing some of your ideas, innovating with them. What are some of the partnerships or applications that are using some of this stuff that you've seen pop up so far that have impressed you?
I'm really excited about the partnership we have very soon with Balancer. So we co-developed, you know, jointly with them a smart pool.
Awesome.
That's similar to Uniswap, but it's sort of aware of Ample's variable supply. So I think this is a bit of an experiment. It's like, we don't know exactly how this is going to impact the market. So we're going to be watching that very closely. But you know, because, you know, so for those who don't know or aren't familiar with Balancer, Balancer is an automated market maker similar to Uniswap, but it's generalized. So you can have, you know, more than two assets, you know, up to eight. You can also have different weights associated with them. So instead of being forced to have a 50-50 pool, you can have a 60-40 or 90-10 pool, for example. So the way this smart pool works is, you know, when the ample supply changes, we can adjust the weights so that the ratio adjusts by the same proportion. So what this does is it reduces your exposure to what's called impermanent loss as the liquidity provider. Right. So it kind of patches up one of the ways in which you can lose value versus holding the assets outside of the pool. So this can be really interesting to see. It's going to be out there fairly soon. But there's some important differences there. So Evan alluded to earlier, the price on Uniswap adjusts immediately when the supply does. And so the price changes immediately to account for that. On the Balancer side, in this specific smart pool, at least, since the ratios change to account for that, then the price remains static. And so that leads to different sort of market feedback than exists on Uniswap. And so I'm really interested to see how it behaves. I'm really excited about the potential, but we do need to look really closely at how it impacts the market itself to know, you know, what to do with that in the future.
Yeah, I would say categorically, the way Ample interplays with other kind of ecosystem players is really encouraging, right? So because it is diversified, it's uncorrelated with Bitcoin, it can be held in a basket. And that would be interesting for the collateral asset use case for services like Maker or anything else that needs to kind of manage a basket of pure cryptocurrencies. In the case of Balancer, like Brandon said, it has this ability to eliminate impermanent loss because it piggybacks off of this supply change number, which has an implied understanding of what the 24-hour volume weighted price of the previous day was built into it. And in lending platforms, it's really interesting because it borrows like a stable coin, right? So most people, when they borrow on things like Compound, they want to borrow dollars, because if they borrow anything else, say I'm borrowing like Link, I don't know what my debt obligation is going to be in the future. It's kind of like if you and I shook one another's hands and said, like, look, you know, if the Lakers make it to the finals, I'll give you 10 Link, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, the price of Link changes and I'm like, oh crap, my debt obligation is not what I thought it was going to be and I'm going to default. That's why most people borrow stable coins. But on Compound, people want to lend their cryptocurrencies because they want to get passive income on assets that they're holding and not really ready to exit their position on. With Ample, you can do that in theory, but it's also a reasonable asset to borrow because it has this cyclical price. You know that, like, you wouldn't kick yourself if you kind of opened a debt contract that said, like, I'm going to pay back, you know, 1,000 Ample and hold it for like 10 years, right? In 10 years, your debt obligation is still 1,000 Ample. Now, that's different if you're just like holding Ample the asset. If you're holding the asset in, you know, wallet, you might actually see the number of Ample you own multiply 1,000-fold in 10 years. But for smart contracts and for contract denomination, it's really useful. So it's cool in that it's the first uncollateralized cryptocurrency that can be used for debt denomination. And that's becoming a really big part of DeFi today. And so we'll be pushing forward some efforts there as well. We're excited about that as well.
It's definitely the podcast that Trump and President Xi don't want America or China to hear, because the game that they're playing right now is print more money and to devalue the currency in order to devalue the debt that they owe one another. And so in this situation, you know, Ample as a denominator of debt, you can never dilute that debt, essentially, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Very fascinating. Guys, we don't have much longer. We want to ask you guys a couple closing questions. But before we dive into the closing questions, I want you guys to try and each give me your best definition of impermanent loss, because this is a very new concept. We get asked it all the time, just in the DeFi circles and stuff. So I'd love to source your guys' individual definitions of what that really is.
So I can give an example, even just in regular markets, right? So the way Uniswap works is there's two pools of assets and it quotes a price based off of the relative size of those pools. That's completely uninformed about the state of the outside market, right? So say you're a market maker on the New York Stock Exchange, right? And you're selling rice. You're going to quote a certain price based off of the market price of what rice is today. And then say some news comes out that a geological event wipes out half of the rice fields, and suddenly the supply of rice is a quarter of what it used to be, right? You're going to use that information to update the price at which you sell rice. But Uniswap doesn't do that on the whole with assets, right? So if the outside price of, say, rice on Uniswap changed, it would continue to sell its inventory at below the market price until it walks along the curve, the difference of the two pools, to reach the equilibrium price of the outside market. So during that whole time, it's selling its inventory for cheaper than it should. So that's what impermanent loss is.
Interesting. Okay. I kind of like it. Evan, you want to take a crack at it?
I feel like that was about as good as my understanding of impermanent loss is. I mean, there's actually a couple of really good blog posts that we can kind of circulate here and attach that I think are pretty authoritative on how to calculate impermanent loss. But I feel like
awesome.
That was pretty close, Brandon.
Perfect. Well, guys, we really appreciate your time. A couple quick questions to close us out. And these are just to get a little bit of color around who you guys are and what makes you tick. But I'll ask Evan this question. Evan, of all the people that you've kind of run across in the crypto space, tell me about one person that has really inspired you, motivated you, given you some nugget of an idea that was really inspiring.
I mean, hands down, like the one person that has influenced me personally, and I know this is probably true of Brandon too, from the beginning of this project, has been Joey Krug. So, you know, Joey is the chief investment officer at Pantera, but prior to that, he was also the founder of Augur. And before, you know, we had raised any money from Pantera, we started to kind of ask him a lot of questions, maybe even 6 months before we even started working seriously on any sort of cryptocurrency. And he led us to a lot of really, really valuable research, and it has kind of shaped the way I think. And I think it really had a huge impact on what we ended up building. And he continues to be a very, very solid advisor for us, just a really, really high horsepower mind.
Yeah, definitely. He's one of our favorite guests and keynote speakers on our summits. So we're really grateful any chance we get an opportunity to dive into that guy's brain. Super, super helpful. And then lastly, Brandon, this question is for you. If this was the first podcast someone getting into the space heard, what would you want them to know?
I'd say do your own research. Because a lot of the first ways people interact with any part of crypto is usually by buying something. So before you do that, understand what it is you're actually acquiring. Right. So there's a saying in poker. I don't know if you guys are poker players. If you look around the table and you don't know who the chump is, it's you. Right. If you are trading actively in crypto and you don't know what it is you're actually trading, then you're the person who might get the short end of the stick when that comes around. So I think that's just important. Not everyone has to interact with crypto, but from a trading, speculating point of view either. A lot of people would just love to build, and crypto is a great playground to build a lot of things. And so if that's who you are, I'd say just get your hands dirty and do something, because you got to start somewhere. Even if it doesn't turn out to what you were hoping for it to be, it gives you skills, knowledge, and it can get you friends with other people in the space that might turn into something else down the line.
Couldn't agree more, guys. Those are awesome closing answers. Do your own research, know what the heck you're getting into, and get involved. So guys, thank you so much. We will circulate, Evan, those notes on impermanent loss in the show notes. All your Twitter handle and, you know, Telegram stuff will be in there as well. So guys, you go and have an awesome week. And we hope to talk with you guys again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care.